Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do, from Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear.
Good afternoon and welcome to Home Run. Today's subject is based on the 2025 World Bank standard, standard for development economy, standard for development discussion or standard for development report. Sorry, CAFIN. Now, let me start with a story I found on page 34.
No, start. Shoot away.
Thank you.
I actually have a lot of localized ones, primarily to try and understand what that report highlighted to us.
You know, I'm starting with this story.
Okay.
It's because there's something that I find very insulting on page 73. Now.
Okay, let's hear it. The particulars of like the introductory setting helped me to understand. Okay, that's why we're not growing so fast in manufacturing.
Yeah.
But yeah, you first start, Hamel. You first start.
All right. So, from the introduction of the report, and by the way, the introduction for some reason is on page 34.
Yeah.
Nearly 4,000 years ago.
What?
That's how it starts. Now, and it gets worse. Nearly 4,000 years ago, a dissatisfied customer in Mesopotamia city-state of Ur penned the first recorded complaint in human history. Like, wait, what?
Are we serious?
This a report. We are supposed to be serious, but now this now how am I supposed to be serious reading that with a straight face? Now,
okay then. Yeah. Okay, guys. Everything in the Bible is fact. Since we can now state a customer,
thank you very much.
A dissatisfied customer's report or complaint from
4,000 years. Now, what were what was this guy who complained 4,000 years ago? What was he complaining about? Well, he was complaining about today's subject, which is standards of measurement in trades. You are talking about liters, kgs, basically every units of measurement you can think of.
Yeah.
Now, this,
did he drop off a piece of papyrus for that?
Whether or not he threw a tantrum is not recorded.
Did they carve out a piece of stone? Oh my goodness.
It's literally carved on stones. That's where they complain. I think it's the longest surviving complaint.
I think that was the drop your queries here, please. Suggestions.
Yeah, in Egyptian times, you had to carve it in a stone. Like, imagine how angry you're gonna have to be. By the time you get to the second paragraph, your anger is gone.
The World Bank is not serious.
The World Bank is low key taking my job here.
They are not serious. How do they want anyone to be serious on that page? In that chapter? My heart just sank in the first, it wasn't even the first chapter. I think it was like the introduction of the whole thing. I was like, oh my goodness.
4,000. Some dude complained 4,000 years ago about, what was he complaining about? The complaint was written on a clay tablet with a cuneiform script, a flourishing example of standardized medium used for formal communication across parts of the region. The region charges a copper trader. And it was a medium of communication that was used also in the copper trade because the homeboy was complaining about, the measurements of copper. That he was sent, I think that they were, that he was told that he, you know, he was told that, they were sending him and the measurements that he was using. I think the copper was coming from a different jurisdiction, like that used a different, copper measuring methods. Now, and then they said, a Nasir with several, breaches of commercial, the complaints were based on several breaches of commercial expectations, the delivery of standardized copper, significant delay in transportation, and mistreatment of his servants. In other words, this one, if you look at it, there were delivery standards that were available. There were call it seventh treatment, aka this would be, I think, what evolved 4,000 years later into, this would be our equivalent of the International Labour Organization standards. The dispute arose from the difference in measurement system used to weigh copper at a source and the destination. Trade disputes.
And remember, that was about, what they call it? The extractive sector, even.
Yeah.
So it wasn't.
Man, the extractive sector goes way back.
So it isn't even something about the aspect of, like, bread baked at whichever source, or the quantity of flour used to bake the bread, or the measurements in terms of weighing the flour to identify what is the particular sort of, like, utilized amount in terms of baking the bread. So yeah. This was literally about a piece of copper. Okay, but it was also the time when they had the copper age.
Yeah, the copper was the diamond at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is understandable.
Yeah.
But yeah, you were still saying, Helmut, about the first page and then the second page in the story?
Well, today we're reading this. Well, I'm reading it on my tablet, but mine is electronic.
Yeah,
the story I'm reading was recorded on a tablet. Leave me a whole different tablet, much heavier, and can be used as a murder tool. And
A paperweight, you know, a very heavy paperweight.
Very heavy paperweight. Yeah. Now, just in this, 4,000 years old story, you can find especially just the part of. The part behind the dispute. It's not in paragraphs, so it's kind of difficult to basically split up. The dispute arose from a difference in measurement system used to weigh copper at a source. That means where the copper was, where the copper was taken from, from the seller to the recipient, the gentleman now that would write a complaint that 4,000 years ago would be reading. The source and the destination had different copper measurements, and the allegations of servants' mistreatment further suggest expectations of basic normative labor standards.
So it was labor costs, transport costs, handling costs, warehousing costs.
You know what I don't understand?
Extraction costs.
Mistreatment of his servants.
Yeah, because it was now an inconvenience, because remember, this is a time that had slavery. The Mesopotamians had slaves.
So,
they are using a euphemistic term there.
But look, I know that part.
To paint over it. That's why we've got the lovely story of Moses, you know.
What do you mean mistreatment? They are your slave. Aren't you mistreating them already?
Because obviously he's talking from a perspective of, okay, I've got this aspect of property. That's just why the conversation around the property law and the economics of property ownership is so, in 2026 specifically, in this 21st century, it is such a contentious issue. Many of the people specifically that look at property law or try to understand property law or try to...
Don't dig much into its history. You're not going to like it.
Yeah, they don't. And secondly, they don't understand the economic systems that have tried to replace aspects of property.
Yeah.
So what is our first fundamental idea that we've ever heard of property law? Was things that are from the Bible? Was things from ancient history? The aspect in terms of knowing that the commodity, the human commodity known as slaves, was a prized commodity, which was also the particular activity linked to the spoils of war. You know, you get attacked because this big force wants to...
Whatever it is that you have.
Firstly, they want your land. Secondly, they want to expand...
So it's expansion of their territory.
Expand territory.
And whatever it is that's on that territory.
And when they have literally vanquished your army or your forces, the surviving members of your population or your ethnic group or your traditional group or whatever that still survive... then become like either slaves directly or, through spoils of war, or they become like what Genghis Khan did. His name is known as Genghis Khan. What Genghis Khan did,
As in Mongol.
Yeah, the Mongol. He expanded in terms of the cultural diversity. So he didn't just have Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists in and Taoists. They also looked, the people also looked differently. But he tried to unite them through a common template of saying, listen, there's one governance format. But just like we've got the regional governors, each one of those particular territories had their own set of laws that still speak to an overarching, as I was told, set of laws that come through from, what was the term he had? The term he had was the Khan, specifically, the Mongols. They don't have a king. It was the Khan.
Oh.
So, yeah, you can look back into history to also try and identify the aspects of property law and what is individual property, which will also help you understand to an extent how this discussion of standardization that you and I are looking into for today, obviously, provided by the very lovely World Bank Group, helps us to also understand. But Alma, just like you started off with a story, I've also got to start with a story.
Yeah.
A story which the World Bank Group actually in page 4, I think, identify. Now, they give their own story of India, the United States, and Korea. India, the United States, and Korea, three different geographic locations around the world, three different countries today that are in their own rights, significant economic powers, highlighting to us, specifically Namibians, that there is an opportunity that can be achieved. There is an opportunity. I also didn't see it until I understood the first story that they told, specifically where standardization actually comes from. Standardization comes from that McLean guy that realized, oh, the goods have to be transported and handled so many times, and they have to be offloaded and unloaded and stored here and stored there, and sometimes taken out of the crates and put back into the crates. Every time there's a handling element taking place. Instead of just, if the good is packaged here at source, it moves in that same package just like this, continuously in the same state, without being, reopened, repackaged, reshifted, remodeled, redone this, and it's just in the same packaging in that constant state until it gets to the end user. Now, that was a wonderful idea, because they highlighted specifically how it multiplied, how trade literally between developed and industrial countries multiplied between 1920 and up to 1950. That's in that page 4 story that they're telling there about how standards came to be. And literally that the standardization literally helped various functions to be simplified. For example, if you take the American discussion, what that McLeod guy did, or McLean, what he did was literally, there was so many people making different parts and different stuff and different that and different this. And no one ever went and okay, I'm assuming from the story that they told me there that I read in that on that page that the manufacturers of, for example, like the beds, because he speaks of the bed springs, that the manufacturers of the beds supposedly never did market research from their customers, because apparently they were like massive sizes and various kinds of springs and different variations, and it was ridiculous things. And that particular example, Helmut, pops up in an example that I watched just at the end of last year when just before I went to China. I watched a story. It was during the holiday period. I watched a story by it's a specific YouTube channel that goes and talks to real change making business executives, how they literally turned around or implemented a turnaround strategy to keep a specific company still existing and now competitive. And the story was based upon Peugeot, the French name, the French car
automaker.
Yeah. So Peugeot is France's oldest automaker in terms of just history, because Renault and Citroën belongs to Renault, I think. Renault, Citroën, there's another, there's an Akkad, no, it's just those three. They came late on. But Peugeot, which had its longest factory, it had the longest, the oldest factory and the longest running factory complex in France, in the city of Sochaux, which is a specific town where the Peugeot, the original Peugeot plant still runs till today, operated. Now, the current CEO they had, they interviewed this guy, Helmut, this YouTube platform. They interviewed him about his business strategy. Now, at the heart of everything, and this was, and this is how a conflicting perspective also comes in terms of what's the best strategy, what's the best kind of a person with the best kind of skills to lead a specific business in a specific sector. For example, if you're a media company, what kind of a person do you need to lead the media company? If you're a engineering company, what do you need? What does that person need in terms of skills and background to lead an engineering company? If you're a mining company, so on and so forth. I remember the reason why I'm bringing up this extra story in the story that I'm explaining is that a lecturer, one of the lecturers I had back on university, specifically in my marketing qualification, said there are two people, according to him, that are the best candidates always to become the CEO of a company. It's either someone that has a marketing degree, and now it's also the business administration degree, or it's someone that has an accounting degree. Now, a business and marketing, a marketing degree / business administration degree, these are people that would try to look for opportunities where the company can obviously try to expand in or try to grow in or develop a new market there, or they would know how to include new ways of doing the same thing, doing the same service or company operations. And a accountant, obviously, as your CEO, would obviously then try to look at cost minimization and becoming cost effective and managing costs to the best of their ability while still trying to maintain output. However, I never, in this short little story I'm telling you, I'm never hearing about standardization from a marketing perspective or business administrative perspective, or from an accounting perspective. I'm not hearing anything of standardization until I watched this particular Peugeot story. So Peugeot had to restructure. They were losing sales. And they didn't know what was wrong, primarily. When they appointed their current CEO, a Frenchman, whose background is that he was a former race car driver, but he was like a backup driver, and he's got an engineering degree, in terms of his education skill set. When they appointed him, people in the business world were like frowning. Why are you appointing a former race car driver?
Engineer.
People were like, you know, isn't this sort of like a bad mix situation? Because he came from the Opel group, the group that had Opel, General Motors. And it also achieved some aspect of success there in terms of their turnaround strategy at Opel. And this is literally just after, and he joined Peugeot right after the financial crash. So I'm talking about 2011-2010 period. When he joined Peugeot, the first thing he did is he went to the factory. And when he got to the factory, Helmut, there was options and variations for the same car. You had access as a customer. You had access to 28 different designs of a steering wheel. And the only thing he asked the production manager or the head of the factory was, does the customer need an option?
So much different varieties of
steering
wheels.
Much options for a steering wheel. And then apparently what he discovered, because he was interviewed, and he said literally, there were these particular things. Now, in some cases, you could immediately identify them as wastage in manufacturing.
Yeah.
You could identify it as waste because you would obviously, after a specific time, you would realize the customers, majority of the customers only go for a basic steering wheel design. So
they don't pay much attention to it. If they need any type of make and model, or if there are different type or models of it.
Unless the steering wheel comes with a time machine or something that does something of significance or adds something significant value to the customer, I don't understand why you would need 28 variations of a steering wheel or different designs of a steering wheel. So it's on certain, those kind of things that he started cutting down on. Now, someone would also argue then, does that not sound like cost efficiency? Yes and no. Why? Because in the example of the mattresses and other things that the Americans achieved pre-World War I or up to World War I was that the American government realized that they were going to go into war, and they literally told the manufacturers, keep it simple and keep it basic. Now, the customer complained for Mesopotamia, probably, yes. There were variations of things back then, and obviously there were no cameras and no proper research, and obviously
this guy must have been angry to chisel a complaint.
Because accusations can get out of hand over there.
Yeah.
But when you look at the aspect of what happens there, so he's the particular example you highlighted from Mesopotamia starts from a customer expectation perspective, whereas the American perspective on mattresses, also with the standardization that McLean guy provided, and the Peugeot example, which speaks into that American example, was a question of wastage / spending too much time on different designs, whereas you just selecting the designs specifically that sell the most. And you try to amplify that. And standardization actually then starts to make sense a lot.
Yeah.
Now, I'll also add in a personal story specifically to this standardization scenario. My sister is a soap maker. They call them, the term she told me, that's that they are known as artisanal or craft. Yeah. No, what do they call those people? Handmade soap makers, because they make everything.
They're handmade.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, there's a mixer that's slightly mechanical, it goes like that. But on that particular indication, I have observed my sister for the past 15 years of making soap. She has standardized her recipes.
Now, when you think of it that way, you begin to understand just how much standards that we work with on a day-to-day basis without first realizing that that's exactly what we're doing, whether you're cooking or...
True. Whether you're measuring ingredients. True.
Whether
you're doing shopping even.
Yeah. I mean, you have all these... Like when you walk into a store, for example, and you buy something, it's standard for you to be given a receipt.
True.
Yeah, in case you get home and the product is faulty, you can return it.
Yeah.
And now when you come back, if you don't get the receipt, which we more often do, and then you get home or you just toss it somewhere, then you get home and realize that the product is faulty and you come back, that's the first thing they're gonna ask for.
Yeah.
Yes, you can return it for a refund, or yes, we can exchange it, but where's the receipt? So, because the standard operating procedure is every time that you buy something, you must have proof of ownership.
Mm. And the proof of ownership, obviously, now that speaks into a business practice and also an extension of what they call that thing, the warranty guarantee scenario, cash refunding policies of an organization. And remember, companies can decide, or businesses can decide, whether or not they wish to give cash refunds or refunds for, they call them guilt purchases or...
like for a faulty product.
No. A faulty product or damaged product would in some cases have already been identified and taken off the shelf.
Yeah.
But let's say you're buying from someone's family business down the street.
Yeah.
Then, you can identify that there could be certain particular hurdles in terms of negotiation process. But what I've loved of the South African businesses that operate in Namibia, and the South African businesses have standardized, Helmut, the Credit Agreements Act of Namibia, which is technically the exact copy of the Credit Agreements Act of South Africa. They've utilized it, hence the reason also why the South African businesses are the most resilient in the Namibian economy. Doesn't matter come rain or shine or come, you know, any particular economic negative development. The first thing you will identify from them is that they clearly set out a return policy. A return policy is a refund policy. A damaged good return policy. And as well as also, you know, the time frame under which you can act and by which they can honor a return policy, a refund policy, or even a damaged good policy. Mm. When you see that, it's immediately a standard that's issued to the customer. But it's an automatic application.
Yeah.
Helmut, you must always, when you walk into consumer shops or retail shops, always look for their retail policy. You will either find them on their receipts, or you will see there's a sign at the door that will highlight a sign at the door or a sign at the cashier.
Yeah.
That they will.
Yeah, but more often they are the back of your receipt.
They're at the back of your. Now those are the South Africans because they are so much more sophisticated that they can personalize that particular messaging to you.
Yeah.
Now, if you've tried this with with Namibian businesses or local businesses, go and try and achieve a return policy with Namibian businesses. I will tell you today, firstly, level of sophistication is pretty difficult to identify. Because in many cases, the cashier or the shop attendants are not empowered enough to know how do they deal with a issue. And this issue could be a client that now bought a liter of milk from you from the fridge. The client goes out literally into the sun, drives home, or walks home, opens up the milk, and the milk is expired. Technically, milk can't technically expire. It just takes a different shape. But let's go with the expiration labeling.
Yeah.
The concern from that would be, Helmut, now that customer gets back into their shoes or gets back into their car, drives back or walks back to the shop, and this is now a Namibian shop, and tells the Namibian shop, hey, listen, I bought this milk. Here's my receipt. I bought this milk from you just now a few minutes back. I'd like to return it, and I'd like a better product. Or return my money, please. Straightforward request.
Yeah.
Now, the best example I've ever seen was when I once bought a Chelsea bun from a local retailer. I shall not mention names for the sake of probably not ending up in some sort of legal aspect or, you know, discussion. But when I just highlighted that to the store manager, the manager was immediately just like, sorry, sir, we're really sorry about it. We'll just immediately give you a cash refund.
Yeah.
Straightforward action on that. Now, standardization, literally from what the World Bank is trying to highlight. And the World Bank book, dear listeners, that we're obviously citing, Helmut and I, that we're dissecting, that obviously has a lot of application to Namibia, is titled the World Development Report of 2025.
Yeah.
And they start from a standardization perspective. Now, I never knew, guys, just to let you know, that standardization has such a particular pivotal impact in the sense that it literally can, firstly, amplify trade, and secondly, that it can actually amplify innovations within your sectors that have to do a lot of trade, either locally or cross-border. The Indian example is the most puzzling, which was significant itself. Why? Because I am so glad that we do not use the imperial system in measurements.
That's what I thought.
Super but, glad.
Yeah, the Brazilian guys really use imperial because there's a salon in the street there's a lady operating a salon.
Yeah.
And every time that they're talking about the length of the hair, they're always doing, you know 13 inches, 15 inches. I'm like, inches? And how are you guys with inches?
An inch, Helmut, is this part of your thumb. That's an inch.
Oh.
Now,
okay, but one person's thumb. Those are imperial.
Yeah. One person's thumb can be taller than another person's thumb or longer than another person's thumb.
Now you see the problem.
One person's foot size can be bigger than another person's foot size. Mm-hmm. So whose foot are we talking about? What is the average size of a Namibian in terms of finger for this part of your thumb, that top part, in terms of foot or shoe size? In terms of average height, because
different people come with different hand sizes, foot sizes, height sizes.
Don't get into the weight discussion of the imperial system, because they use things like pounds, ounces, and stone. Stone, Helmut. I am so glad we immediately adopted the metric system.
Just when you know what?
There's a cooking book that we inherited from my mom after her passing that is so old, it still has the imperial system in it. I once had to translate, what is 5 ounces to grams? Please, 5 ounces to grams. Now, ounces is not always written in its full form, you know, the O-U-N-C-E-S, ounces.
They use O-Z.
They use O-Z sometimes.
And the symbols are way off.
And when they write pounds, they write
LB.
Yeah, LB or LBS to indicate
plural.
And not everyone understands why they chose LBS and why they chose
kilogram, kg.
Stone is pretty straightforward. It's stone. But how many people know about stone from the imperial system?
I didn't think about a stone. I'm just thinking about a literal stone.
Exactly. Because you'd also be sitting there thinking, is this a literal stone we're talking about for weight measurement? And when they looked into the India example at the start of this report, which actually was an eye-opener after India's independence in 1947, the Indian authorities at the time had to go into the whole country. They sent officials into the whole country, Hamut, and asked and tried to find. They literally did a survey of measurements to understand how does the average foot size, the average inch, the average weight. How does it get transmitted? They found a plethora of varying degrees of weight measurements, distance measurements. That was literally feeding into the Mesopotamian example you gave me.
Yeah.
Literally, because the extracting guy, the miner, in the Mesopotamian example, weighed the copper that they extracted.
That the customer wanted to buy.
Yeah.
The look of things, yeah.
They got a weight measurement of X.
Mm-hmm.
And as the thing was
using their measurements.
Their measurement units and their weights and the infrastructure.
Yeah.
And as it was transported to the customer got a different weight measurement. So
I'm assuming the conversion ratios were not matching.
Exactly. Now, when you go into a shop, Helmut, this bottle of energy in front of me, you can clearly see there's 500 ml here.
Yeah.
And according to your eye, this is the size of what 500 ml has to look like.
Mm-hmm.
There's a consistent representation. But it has been bugging me for the past 5, 6, 7 years. You know, is this actually 500 ml?
Is that the capacity? No,
it's the volume.
Is that the volume of the capacity of the container or the volume of the content that's in the container?
That's measured in.
Exactly. Because it's not filled to the brim. Remember that? Yeah.
And which is a very good question you're highlighting as well. Because is the container designated as 500 ml or is the quantity that is put of the substance 500 ml that is weighed off or measured off?
Mm-hmm.
Now, standardization obviously makes it easy as well, because this means if you've got, this bottle would come part of a case of multiple bottles of the same size and the same, obviously, product flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be sold as a case, which is also standardization in terms of packaging. And you would have varying degrees, because you would sometimes know that Coca-Cola packages their two liter plastic bottles in sixes. It looks literally like a six pack of 2 liter bottles, but you call it the standard case is the labeling. But when I give you a six pack of 300 ml cans, you can immediately identify that as a six pack as well. The 6 2-liter bottles is a case. But it looks like a six pack of 2 liter bottles. Mm-hmm. But 6 cans wrapped together in its packaging is known as a 6-pack, which is 6 individual smaller units of measurement from the 2 liter or from a single 1 liter. It's just a 6-pack. And that 6-pack forms part of a 24-pack, which is a standard size packaging and selling unit in trade. Because now everyone knows 6-pack cans comes from 24-pack of cans, which constitutes your basic case of cans. You know, either Coca-Cola cans or beer cans, you buy them in 24-pack. Even the bottles, the smaller bottles, whether it's your ciders or beers, they come part of a 24-pack. But then they would be designated as a crate, because they put in that box situation. Do you see the conversation?
The nitty-gritty around.
And this, Helmut, I all learned this now from working at a bottle store, from observing how the packaging happens, and even how the packaging is translated into the invoicing system. That system that when you go to the till, that scans the product, shows you the price.
Yeah.
That's an invoicing system. And that system has to speak backwards to another particular sort of like a management system that they've got, mm-hmm. where you are feeding in everything that you buy to restock on the shelves. So you've got a checking out system in the front and you've got a checking in system at the back. But the checking in system has to do with deliveries. Deliveries of you going buying stock, mm-hmm. putting it into your shop. You've got to feed that invoice that you got from the supplier. You've got to feed it in. Everything on that invoice, you've got to must have a it must have a label that mm-hmm. you can describe
yeah.
with its barcode, obviously. The barcode is very important because
it's the fingerprint.
Because a barcode is also a standardization mechanism. And then you can go, and after you've fed that whole invoice, they call it goods receiving. After you've fed that whole invoice onto the system and you've adjusted any new pricing measures that need to be adjusted, meaning sometimes the suppliers would give you a heads up that there's going to be X percentage of price increase on cigarettes, you know, every year when it's budget time. Oh, yeah, it might be budget budget next week. I say it might. Budget next week. So, national budget unveiling. So the important thing that would sometimes come out there, which we've heard about, is that there would be either be an increase or an adjustment to the sin taxes. The sin tax is always use your best indicators. That's alcohol and tobacco products. Where they would adjust the percentage there, more tax collection for NAMRA from there. And that obviously would be applied as you, as a small business on the ground, would be applying that percentage adjustment. When it comes through, when literally the standardization and how you look at the packaging and all that, mm-hmm. how it comes through is sometimes also how much the customer would be buying from the product. Or of the product. And then you would sometimes see, okay, so you know that sin tax is punitive because it's literally the get rich quick scheme that anyone wants in history.
Absolutely.
Is applied on sin tax, is applied on alcohol and tobacco products. However, it's also a particular thing that that has an aspect of impact on the industrial side of those products. Now, yes, we might have the factories, but they're no longer Namibian in spirit. The one that, what's the guy's name? The South African guys.
Let's just go with their Namibian in geographic location.
Yeah, they're just
outside of that.
Yeah, they're no longer Namibian, just so that you guys know. And the other one that's been here as old as Namibia, it's no longer Namibian, but it's Namibia in Geus, not in DNA anymore, in Geus only.
I think it's Geus.
Spirit.
Oh, okay.
So, but the standardization still exists. Yeah. The standardization still pulls through. I'm just super glad we use the metric system. It's superior beyond a doubt. You should see Hamud, when you try to watch Indian counting, like when they speak Hindu, or the, you know, There are words that they use for thousand, for million, 100,000. It stops literally, you know, it's easy mm-hmm. when it gets like from the tens to the hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
But past that, there's a term like luck. L-A-K-H.
In what language?
In one of the Indian variants, but...
No, well, for...
But broadly, when they speak Hindi...
Last time I checked, Hindi is one of the most difficult languages.
And Hindi is the most widely spoken one.
Okay.
When they speak Hindi and you hear the word luck, you don't know if it's 3,000, because they even write the word, like, let's say it'll be 3,000 or 300,000 Namibian dollars. Né?
Yeah.
Now, you that the three zeros or the zeros where it need to indicate either 300,000
mm-hmm.
or 3,000, you just have the Namibian dollar sign, the three, and the word luck.
So it's somewhat like the equivalent of what we have, the Westerners have usually use, terms like 10 grand or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Or they would, no, but remember that the Westerners would say 10K or 10 grand.
Yeah, 10K, 10 grand.
10 grand or 10K. Or like the fish rod guys tried to be clever by saying what? Three large? Or what were the terms they were using? Where I was also going like, hey. What's going on over here?
You know, it's my favorite part of that document.
Yeah.
It's where they are telling each other to don't be so loud. Otherwise, we'll end up in the front page of the newspaper. And then they ended up on the front page of the newspaper.
Wow, what irony is that?
Careful what you wish for.
Or careful what you are warning each other of.
Yeah, what you are warning each other.
So, yeah. So yes, it's similar to that, Helmut, you're right. But when we look at standardization... The first question that popped up, and this is where I'm not going to become philosophic here, Helmut.
Yeah.
Is it too late for Namibia to either be the Korea in that document?
In terms of adopting or coming up with our own standards?
Both. Becoming an India or becoming the United States? Because these are three non-European countries that were highlighted. At the start of this document, and each one had adequate exposure to their success story of how they did it.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to draw you back to, remember the National Planning Commission's visit to Korea?
2024. Oh, yeah. Let's go and learn something about how South Korea developed.
Where you and I only discovered at the end of the year that these guys went to Korea. And literally, the presentation was done for them, to them, without them being able to present, obviously.
Yeah, they were just told, well, you came to see how we did it, now just sit and listen.
And it literally could have been.
That could have been a Zoom.
It could have been a Zoom call. But yeah, so they were there. And remember that countries like Germany and... It's the three countries, Germany, Japan, and South Korea. They usually hailed as the three industrial miracle stories of the world because all three of them rebuilt... rapidly after war periods.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously going from completely damaged infrastructure national assets or assets or economic assets in their countries to now being literal economic leaders in their own rights. All three of them. The downside has been there was concerted efforts to assist them in achieving the industrialization.
You asked a very nice question.
Yeah, that's why I immediately identified we need to be philosophic at a specific point in our talk today.
Well, lucky for you, the question of is it too late for Namibia? Please go to page 73. You know where this is headed.
Well, and it's a keen thing.
Yeah. Lessons for who?
For us. It's just for us.
Yeah.
So when I asked that particular question in terms of, you know, just now a few minutes back.
Yeah.
The important thing that I always ask myself at the back of the head is it too late for us to be able to make our own technology? Is it too late for us to be able to make our own clothing? Is it too late for us to start making our own equipment? is it too late for us? Because remember, Helmut, we're sitting with so many standards in our country.
Yeah.
Coming from so many parts of around the world. Many of these standards... And
from food, clothing...
Everything. And these standards now are actually... they're actually documented in the World Trade Organization's... the GATT, the General Agreement on Trade... No. On... The General Agreement on Traded Goods or something like that, but it's because the new one is the GATS, the GATS on services. And every time, it's not an African country leading the way.
Nope.
And this is probably the only time that I could say that literally that South Africa, where I'll not be praising South Africa, because South Africa is literally an innovation taker. They're not an innovation maker.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular regard. But yeah, I'm still trying to get there to 73.
Yeah. Now, while you are, you know...
Is it literal 73 or page 40?
Page 73 on the document.
On the document, yeah. Okay.
Now, there's a... Last year, a Swiss NGO accused Nestle for adding sugar to a certain sort of like a product of Nestle, and that's they added that sugar to only products that were sent to markets like India and Africa.
Mm.
Now, one of the reasons why that NGO basically found that to be sort of like something that Nestle shouldn't be doing is something that they point out here that. This runs counter to 2022 guidelines from the World Health Organization, which warns that early exposure to sugar can create a lasting preference of sugar, of sugary products, and contribute to obesity in children. That's somewhat of an international standard, or you know, UN or WHO signatory. Member states, you know, standards of, you know, of whether or not, sugar must be added to, you know, must be added to children of a specific age range. Now, this involved a lot of, a lot of Asian countries, especially parts of India, and I think around 13 13 African countries.
Mm.
And they have, you know, the NGO was kind enough to basically, share the letter that, you know, their letter of complaint that they electronically chiseled and, you know, sent to Nestle.
Yeah.
Some of the countries now on the second page, it says, do the right thing, not tomorrow, not next year, today. The world is watching and your compliance is not optional. Sincerely, League to Consumer Defense in Benin. And Benin Health and Consumer Survival, again Benin, Consumer Association of Burundi, and Center for Research and Education for Development, that's Cameroon, Ivorian Consumer Association, Ivory Coast, Morocco Society of Nutrition, Health and Environment, that's self-explanatory, Morocco, Morocco's League for the Fight Against Diabetes, again Morocco, and then there's one which is French, and that's Mozambique. And right next after Mozambique, you have Nutrition and Food Security Alliance of Namibia.
But those are the guys that I interviewed last year, the NGO.
Yeah. So clearly, when it comes to children of a certain age range, the World Health Organization regulation, or more like standards, dictate you shouldn't be putting sugar in their products. So this is also one of those, you know, like a easy example of. Disputes, or more like, disputes coming out of standards not being followed. Now, the whole document is a very angry letter. Now, coming back to your question of is it too late for Namibia? Well, the guy seems to have factored that question, or, you know, the somewhat like an answer to that question on page 72 downwards. Mm-hmm. Lessons for latecomers. Well, I assume that would be us.
Well, they're speaking about Asia, East Asia here, but you are right. You can literally apply the same term, late coming.
Yeah.
Man, it makes us sound like we are the last cattle in the kraal.
That's why I started with 4,000 years ago.
We They literally sound like those. You know the. You know those cattle that still want to see. You know what? There's still a nice little grass that I saw that side. That I saw that side. How about we walk there first? But it's already, you know, end of the day.
Yeah.
And only now we're deciding to have Dora the Explorer mentalities at the end of the day. But yeah, it's and here's the thing. You're right, Helmut.
Yeah.
Currently, Namibia is in close orbit to a country like China.
Yeah.
Namibia is also in close orbit to a country like South Africa. But what I've discovered what South Africa does for its industrial protection is if, let's say, a Western manufacturing company decides to close shop in South Africa,
yeah,
it gets replaced with a Chinese manufacturing company. So if a car brand is no longer, a Western car brand is no longer seeing that Southern Africa is feasible as a market,
yeah,
and they close down shop, it gets replaced by a Chinese automaker. Now, it helps us to identify one or two things. Yes, firstly, jobs are being maintained. But that's just a political ploy. That's a political facade you put up to the people who are not asking the real questions of, okay, now what happens to intellectual property or the customer base that you served? I mean, would you really walk away from people that were spending money to buy your product?
Yeah.
Or what happened that led to you not wanting to sell products anymore in Namibia or in South Africa? And then you realize it's a little bit more deeper.
Yeah.
For example, they couldn't get concessions on or preferential particular treatment from the South African government for like incentives and stuff like that. Or, for example, the warning that BMW gave the South African government last year by telling them, hey, listen, you better increase your VTC standards. VTC standards. BMW tells South Africa, increase or improve your VTC standards. Because the people you guys are training, you're training them on engines that are 8 years old. So
you have to keep up with the times.
You have to keep up with the new technology that BMW is bringing out from BMW Germany. Now, when a private company has to tell the government, improve your standards, because we are manufacturing at that level, you want jobs.
We're in 2025. You are still in 2010.
Yeah. You're still on 2010, 2011 engines, training people on those old technologies.
And when they're in the field, they're fixing 2025, 2026.
Variants. Yeah. They're dealing with more electronic cars.
Yeah.
Because this has now been the bigger concern. If anyone has observed between the cars that were brought out between 2010 and the cars that have come out in 2020, more electronics. What's the biggest difference? More electronics that come along.
Yeah.
And now that there are these electronic vehicles, you're now having a car that is a complete computer.
Yeah.
From being a mechanical thing.
Yeah, it doesn't have your traditional internal combustion engine.
It doesn't have the gearbox anymore.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the clutch anymore. Yeah, the program makes you think that there's supposedly a clutch mechanism.
Yeah.
There is no clutch.
Everything is electronic.
Everything is electronic. Now, this makes things weird, Helmut. Because now the late coming is a scenario of, okay, here's the example that this report highlights on page 73, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
So it highlights here that the East African miracle, the East Asian economic miracle, which was the same particular, okay, it was a different report I looked at back in 2023 when I did the business and economic segment, where I asked the question, is it too late for Africa? Because here's the thing, Helmut. People forget that there's economic competition between continents and between countries.
Yep.
Now, what makes it difficult, Helmut, for you and me now to start a cell phone, a smartphone manufacturing company? Not a cell phone manufacturing company, a smartphone manufacturing company. Who are we up against? We're up against Google, because Google developed Android. But Google will say, yeah, we will roll out Android to you. Okay, so we're not worried about operating systems. But who are we actually up against? We're up against the guys that are literally at the start or at the forefront of AI technology with all its patents. the Chinese companies, Samsung, and the American company known as Apple. They all have market share.
Yeah.
Let me say it again. They all have a loyal market share. I stood in the shop a little bit earlier. I could count how many guys had were out standing with their smartphones. Okay, majority of us in the line had Android. 3 or 4 had
Apple.
iPhones. Apple. Apple is a very expensive product. It's a, what do they call that product? It's a luxury good. It's a luxury product.
Yeah.
You could literally classify the Androids for its particular economic perspective of coming in at the affordability, low affordability range and trying to cover as many people in the and the technology as possible. You could view that as a sort of like as a, you know, a basic product, you know, being able to operate at entry level as well. Apple doesn't want to operate at entry level. It won't. That's why Apple loves redressing, repackaging a phone of 3-4 years back. You know that 16E or what was that phone?
Yeah.
That iPhone 10E or 11E or the 8E, which is hardware.
It's supposed to be like the mid-ranges.
Yeah. But it's for Apple, it's like their entry-level phone.
Yeah.
But it's hardware that they overproduced in from 5 or 6 years back that way. And then they bring the hardware back because they realize there's an opportunity for us to make some a little bit extra cash to cover a specific customer in a zone, and they bring it out. Then the phone still costs 15 grand. 15 grootes, Helmut. I mean, 15 big ones for a phone in your hand is a lot of money.
I don't know how much value addition is going into electronics manufacturing, but cell phones, I'm looking at their prices. Some of them are in 20, 30, 40. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Now, look, when it comes to standards, it's impossible not to have some.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's impossible not to have some. There's a reason why, why if you look at the switches that we have here, which is influenced by Germany sort of through South Africa, and and you look at the outlets that you find in Western countries like the US, they're different.
Mm.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously, when it comes to electrical wiring and installations, they're following different standards from the one that we have here. And all these things are obviously all these things are regulated, and transporting is one of those things. There are different standards that you have to meet when it comes to food, when it comes to when it comes to clothing. That's why if you look at your clothing sizes, for example, they come in different. Okay, you see different label that this shoe in UK sizes is this number or is this big, but in US sizes is this big.
We actually now, use the UK foot size.
We use the UK foot size.
Yeah.
Now, this takes us a little bit to HD and C. Trobo's discussion of in this whole, multipolarity discussion, who are we going to, it's like we have to pick a side between the East and the West. And I totally agree with the gentleman when he says, we don't have the luxury. We don't have the luxury of deciding, let's pick one over the other. Let me just say, even if we decide to say, okay, we're going to prioritize, the West over the East or the East over the West.
Yeah.
They both have, they're different ways of doing things.
And where does Africa lie in that discussion?
So that means, whichever side we're going to pick, that side is going to come with a lot of different products that are going to come with a lot of different standards that they already use.
Yeah.
Our job will only be to adopt.
Oh, here's a good standardization aspect, and this is on safety, flight safety, airplane safety.
Yeah.
So what happened, Helmut, was...
You leave Boeing out of that.
No. This is in Chinese airspace.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is, last year, two of the fellow Namibians on our five-person, because I was the only guy, on our 5-person trip to China, brought charging, what's the thing's name? Power banks with.
Uh-huh.
They took power banks. They brought their power banks from Windhoek, from Namibia, and on our flight to China. So Ethiopian Airways is fine. Through immigration and through the scanning and everything, fine.
Yeah.
Moment we landed at China, in Shanghai,
yeah.
It's an issue. Okay, you enter, it's fine. You know, because now we've got to progress to our next, to the other gate, because we've got to fly from Shanghai now to the city of Nanchang. At the other gate, going out now to the plane, there's these warnings that we are told of. No power banks.
Oh.
And it's a power bank standardized and certified by Chinese standards authorities. What was the power bank that they were talking about?
Mm-hmm.
If you have any of the Chinese phone makers, but specifically Xiaomi, the consumer product Xiaomi, it also manufactures, and there's a whole bunch of retailers here in Windhoek that sell that power bank, that Xiaomi power bank.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot more, Xiaomi's particular retail strategy is a lot more aggressive in terms of, you know, shipping out and having the product being, their products being sold everywhere, from these autonomous little vacuum cleaners in your house, you know, that thing that looks like a little robot with a cat sits on top of it. Yeah. To its own little various
smartwatches,
household devices, smartwatches as well. And only their power bank, because they kept mentioning a specific safety standard, a safety certification standard, that does it have this? And these two ladies in my party had, it has the EU symbol on it, which is also a standardization. Certification.
By EU standards.
By EU standards, not by Chinese standards.
Yes.
So that meant that the power bank had to stay at the scanning station.
Yeah.
The people, because they told us, please take out the power bank. You can't go with that power bank onto the plane. Now, when we got onto the plane and we asked the guide that we had when we landed in the city of Nanchang, you know, why did they confiscate our power banks? And then she explained it's because products of a certain quality or a certain particular standardization were brought into China at a stage. Power bank products were brought in, and a customer tried to charge their power bank on the airplane in flight, on the airplane, because you also have ports.
Certain planes have those
electrical ports, and the customer tried to charge the power bank. But the power bank literally short-circuited the plane, which is a safety hazard, which you can obviously see.
Yeah, it is when you're 10 kilometers above ground.
10 kilometers? Helmut, we're a couple of thousand kilometers. Okay, a couple of thousand meters, not a couple of thousand kilometers. A couple of thousand meters above ground. So, I mean, it looks heavy. It looks heavy when you look at the intensity in terms of saying, listen, don't charge your plane. Don't charge your power bank on a plane. Now, obviously, when you're on a plane, you would know that you have to pay for certain things, like you have to pay for Wi-Fi on the plane.
Yeah.
But if you're an economy passenger, you obviously know, my phone is...
It's fine.
Yeah, signal, I don't have to care about signal and stuff like that. I can literally live without my phone.
You can survive the flight.
For like 5 hours. Yeah. And then... get on the airport that side, try to connect to the Wi-Fi, and then on the connecting flight, another 5 hours of obviously, you know, not being connected to the world. But the concern obviously was further than that, because if you get into a country like China, where people are on their phones 24/7, Helmut. Flying back, there was a girly, sorry for using that term, but there was a lady. Yeah, it's probably because she was way shorter than me. And I'm not a tall guy. But there was a lady who was literally watching movies on her phone from Shanghai back to Addis. Sitting like this. Not the movies that they're giving you on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Her movies on her phone.
It's like, you know what? I have my own preference.
And I was wondering, is it on the phone? No, I'm obviously now looking like a weirdo because I'm sitting in on a passenger, you know, seat looking at her screen over there while I'm supposed to look at my screen here. But I was thinking the whole time, oh, is she connected to the internet somehow?
I mean, it could have been something she downloaded. I do that all the time.
Probably. Or it probably is like one of those particular digital economy platforms, meaning it's an application on the phone.
Subscriptions.
You have a subscription and it's like the
you
Netflix.
You can download and watch it offline.
Yeah, it's like the Netflix situation on your phones as well. And it's already on the phone. You just have to open up and play.
Yeah.
And then just put your headphones in. So the situation was, when you look at the standards of things, the situation takes many manifestations around you. It takes various forms or it comes in various forms around you because you see things in a different light. One of the basic things of standardization, Helmut, which we also forget is standardization, is currency and currency, the currency levels you can anticipate.
You know that, exchange rates?
Yeah. You know that one Namibian dollar is one South African rand.
Yeah.
Now, that is a standardization. Yes, Bank of Namibia would use PEG because Bank of Namibia's latest monetary policy announcement came out in this week. But the Bank of Namibia will never explain to you it is a standardization mechanism, even though money is literally a retail element because you're making money move. The idea is that you've got to make money move, that you need as many particular consumer participation to make money move. But at the heart of what NDB6 is trying to achieve is trying to enhance consumer participation in the broader Namibian economy. But consumer participation stems from what? People earning money. People earning money.
Yeah.
Or people having access to money. So, yeah, we had to become a little bit philosophic in that direction. But before we continue, Hamid, let's quickly take a live read.
Yeah.
Wilwitsche University, where the 2026 applications are now extended for the Faculty of Health Sciences for the following courses. Certificate in Health Science Foundation, Diploma in Environmental Health Science, Postgraduate Diploma in Community Health Nursing, Postgraduate Diploma in Mental Health, Postgraduate Diploma in Occupational Health and Safety, Master of Science in Occupational Health and Safety, and the Master of Public Health. For more information, call 081-403-6406. Wilwitsche University, where everyone is an achiever.
And welcome back. We are going to take a quick break and we'll continue on the other side. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. And today's discussion is on global standards and basically, standards of measurement as in, take for example, your units of measurement, like your 30 centimeter ruler, your 1 meter ruler, your shoe sizes, your clothes sizes, they're all coming in different size, they're coming in different sizes, and those sizes are expressed in different are expressed in different units depending on where the product is coming from. And the discussion is based on the 2025 World Development Report, and which is a very based on standards for development that's coming from the World Bank Group. And let's take a break. We'll see you on the other side. This is Home Run with Helmut and Dwight. Stay tuned.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tete opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuana. Unongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi to danjuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwa tafanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu batatu o mafilane Eagle FM VI.
T
Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do, from Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Welcome back. We continue with our standards discussion that is based on the World Bank Group report. Now, coming back to the question that you asked earlier, like, is it too late for Namibia? I think for not just Namibia, but for you know, for the whole of Africa, this is going to it has already done that. It's, you know, it, we have already followed the the template of. Adoption of official languages. A lot of countries adopted the language of the country that colonized them.
French, Portuguese,
yeah, the French, the Portuguese, English. The Spanish, the, you know, the English. How we didn't end up with Germanese.
They even adopted a language that is literally a mixture of Arabic and a few African languages known as Kiswahili.
Yep.
And
which
technically is not an ownership aspect of even of Africa.
So we just...
Even the name Africa is not even indigenous to the continent even.
Nope.
Because it's a Roman name. There was a Roman with the name Scipio Africa. I had to go and Google that thing. I would go like, is this really? Yeah. Scipio Africa.
Its name is not Africa. Just finish the name. That guy is a funny name.
Okay, Scipio Africanus.
That's my favorite part of the name.
Africanus. So, even when you look at this particular conversation, Helmut.
Yeah.
Look, when we had the World Economic Forum talk of last week, I loved what the two South Africans, Wandile Mene and Johan Strydom, highlighted. We need to change the particular perspective of Africa in a scenario where... We try to think as one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying we follow the political noise that the Pan-Africanists are making, because I still believe in sovereignty and in sovereign identity, in terms of Namibia's particular identity. I'm not calling for open border scenarios, because other countries have a problem in terms of dealing with immigration on the African continent, notably South Africa, I think Nigeria, and much of the rest of Africa, whereas we know we've got limited resources, we can't entertain everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there's also other particular things that we need to balance, specifically nature conservation, environmental management, so on and so forth. Even though there is a little bit of a fragmentation on those particular fronts happening, because you have environmental championing happening from the environment and forestry stakeholders, which also includes the ministry associated to that. And then you get the agricultural guys, which also includes it's their own ministry. And we've got a report that documents that very lovely from the OAG's office, doing the exact opposite, degrading and actually destroying
the natural environment. Yeah,
that literally... damages the natural environment, or puts the natural environment and habitats and ecosystems in harm's way. So internally, we just have to fix synchronization. We just have to fix alignment of things, which would help with standardization even for investors to participate. But there's actually a better thing, Helmut, that happened in this report.
Oh, boy.
They made mention of CBAM. Remember CBAM?
Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, yeah.
Exactly. Now, remember, I think it's this year that CBAM is actually taking full effect.
Yeah.
But it's putting things under strain specifically for countries that are trading with the EU. Now, I just.
Especially developing countries that are still need a lot of funding for their energy transition.
And the World Bank literally states it in this report, in that section specifically, when you're looking at the developing world now exporting standards to the developing nations. So when we're talking about CBAM.
Yeah, because CBAM itself is an EU standard they just came up with.
Yes, it's an EU standard. Second onto that is specifically the potential problematic area that the World Bank observes. This is not Dwight and Helmut.
With regards to the adoption of...
With regards to the... And remember, this is all based upon a notion of, what's the thing's name, trying to help with development. Because the report is mentioned, or is titled, World Development Report.
Yeah.
Because it's overall development. So, when they speak of CBAM, they start off this particular section of CBAM like this. Consider just one area, climate. The European Union Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism is designed to ensure that not only European firms but global suppliers to the EU as well reduce their emissions. Because that's what CBAM actually tries to do.
Yeah.
Because it actually encourages, well, you could use the word encourage, but it's a mechanism of forcing you. If you're going to trade with the EU, you're being forced
to meet these standards.
Now, the EU has not just done this once. They've done this before. If you can go and look at any electronic product,
yeah,
it must have, for it to be traded in the EU, it must have that CE certification
label.
Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which means it meets EU trading standards.
Well, they told Apple the same thing, back to C-type or get the heck out of here.
There, another good example. Yeah. Thank you, Helmut. Thank you. So, here is what the next sentence says after where I ended with emissions, to reduce the emissions. It imposes a carbon price on imports in 6 sectors. Cement, aluminium, iron and steel, fertilizers, hydrogen and electricity. Firms that export their goods to the EU must measure, report and verify the emissions their products cause in accordance with the established standards. If they cannot provide credible data at the plant level, the EU uses default values that can overstate actual emissions levels. Continuing on, just to end at the last part, the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism constitutes the most ambitious climate policy experiment worldwide to date, an earnest effort to reduce emissions that reflects the EU's values regarding sustainability, fairness, and consumer responsibility, yet it threatens to widen the global divide between rich and poor countries. Now, what does that also translate to, Hamid? It translates to the Peugeot plant in Balfour. No. I'm not making now a joke situation here. It's actually a good example, which we've actually kept reinforcing in our minds.
Yeah.
But it does show a very good example. Because the Peugeot plant was literally a get into manufacturing quick fix approach. Not get rich quick fix,
yeah,
a get into manufacturing quick fix.
Like instant porridge, but for manufacturing.
Exactly. Mm. We want all the details and all everything else already done for us so that we don't have to explore and find out what...
We don't want to invest in our own S&D.
Yeah, we don't want to build the nuts and bolts and manufacture it locally, or the particular windscreen made for the car. Yeah. No. We just want to start something that starts off something. Just for the sake of starting it. Not for the sake of actually saying, hey, you know what? Let's try and approach one of Namibia's micro enterprises in the country and ask them, hey, listen, so... You make cement, ne? Yeah. So how about you try to diversify that activity into actually becoming a technology company from just being a cement manufacturing company? Because cement is also reliant, remember, on mining. You have to mine the specific mineral known as fluorspar that I mentioned before.
Yeah.
You have to mine the mineral, and the mineral has to travel to the cement manufacturing plant. And manufacturing cement is a pollutant activity. It's a polluting activity. So, no, Namibia is not doing that. Namibia is not inviting established businesses to transform themselves and also transform Namibia's economic prospects. No, we want startups. So, Helmut, today you must first go and you must go start your own small enterprise. You must struggle for 2 years or maximum 5.
Yep.
As a MSME, go struggle for 5 years. In between, you experience the highs and lows of forms of dementia, forms of, you know, anxiety and hair loss, and
sleepless nights.
And in between sleepless nights, and sometimes also people that you owe money calling you and, you know, threatening your, not just physical well-being, but also your emotional well-being to into kingdom come and all that kind of situations. And then only after that 5 years, because Namibia doesn't conform to the 2 year time frame. Only after that 5 years does your company now only start standing on its own feet, where it actually pays your salary and it pays itself and it just runs, you know, like a lovely racehorse. Now the downside is, unfortunately, that's not the template Namibians want to hear. They don't want to hear about grinding it out.
You know, you have to wait 5 years.
They don't want to hear about grinding it out. They literally don't want, Helmut, they don't want to hear about grinding it out.
Yeah, I know that from the, you know, from the statistics of people getting scammed. Yeah. I want to get me, I want to get rich. I want to make my money now. I mean, I have $1,000 today. I want to make, you know, 10K by the end of the week.
Oh, you should also see the scams on YouTube. Yeah, you just need $1,000.
Yeah,
$1,000 is $16,000.
Look, maybe it's an age thing, but I'm at that point where I become very suspicious when you're telling me about something that doesn't require breaking a sweat.
I'm also suspicious of something specifically when it's dictated to you.
Yeah, like, you know what, like, you can tell it's being sold. Here's one thing I know about me.
Yeah.
You know, just, you know, because more often I look at these things from my personal, what would I do? If I had an infinite money glitch idea, which the last thing I would do is share it with everyone.
First and foremost, your infinite money glitch must not include your own ATM or your own bank.
Yeah.
Because where are you going to get infinite money from, Helmut? Do you know that that in this report, they're also busy standardizing cryptocurrencies? Now, here's the thing. The African economies are trying to get into these realms.
So, with the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, for example, so, okay, obviously, standards are going to apply, and you can see that... you know, countries with Spanish history in terms of colonialism, and Portuguese, French, and you have the English, you have the Dutch, and there you have the Italian. Just a little bit briefly, the side of Ethiopia.
It's actually Eritrea.
Eritrea.
Eritrea kept most of its Italian influences.
Jeez.
Yeah, because literally they don't have internet, Helmut. Do you know that?
Eritrea.
Yeah. When you fly there, the only internet you can get is at the age-old internet cafe. Do you still see internet cafes in Namibia? Okay, I don't see them in Windhoek. I know they might be in other towns. I don't see internet cafes anymore. They still have internet cafes in Eritrea.
Yeah, I'm more paranoid about public connections. Unless it's work or home, I'd rather use my data.
But here's the thing also. Who standardized that? Who standardized the router, the modem, the Wi-Fi, the Wi-Fi dongle?
Definitely not us.
Exactly. And at every particular corner, that world, that development report is literally highlighting how countries like Namibia are further and further growing. The divide between a country like Namibia.
That's where
I can't even mention Germany in the sentence.
I think that's where page 73 of message for the latecomers now comes in.
But we're even after those latecomers of Asia.
Definitely.
Because when I read that comparison report back in 2023 about, you know, what's potentially at risk for the continent of Africa in terms of becoming a manufacturing hub. The biggest risk for Africa was it has to now compete with China.
Yeah.
So now how are you going to compete?
You just joined athletics and your first opponent is Frank Fredericks.
No, but it's Frank Fredericks that trained you.
Yeah.
He taught you all the, you know,
how to eat
naturally, you know, stick to natural foods, don't include certain particular foods in your diet, how to train on his particular regimen. Now you're training on his level. Now you're running as fast as him. You were gonna compete now with him.
Look, I'm not being trained how to box by Harriet Simon, and then I walk in a boxing ring with him. Not a chance, but live read.
Okay, live read. Vavice University, for the 2026 applications that are now extended for the Faculty of Health Sciences for the following courses: Certificate in Health Science Foundation, Diploma in Environmental Health Science, Postgraduate Diploma in Community Health Nursing, Postgraduate Diploma in Mental Health, Postgraduate Diploma in Occupational Health and Safety, Master of Science in Occupational Health and Safety, and Master of Public Health. For more information, call 081-403-6406. Velvici University, where everyone is an achiever. Yeah, guys. So, our issues regarding
standards.
Well, not just standards.
And our ideas in manufacturing.
Industrial growth.
We have two issues. Like, if you ask me, when it comes to manufacturing,
yeah,
as a continent,
yeah,
the standards, that's the least of our worry. Yeah. Standards, that's the least of our worry.
I also think it's the least of our worry.
Yeah, it's the least of our worry. Because we, you know, just like I mean, it's like us sitting here and talking about the adoption of what official language are we going to use. Well, French, former French colonies use French.
And
we
then
use
we still,
English.
And then like, we still go and argue with each other at the Pan-African Parliament.
We communicate just fine.
About who is speaking what language.
Yeah, fluently. That's really dumb. Now, I know, right?
Hey, African.
It's a serious joke. Now, if you ask me, we have the modes of communication, aka in languages. Yeah. We seem to have, we are not on the same footing. We haven't completely figured it out, but we're doing just fine in terms of communication. We have, the African Union, they just recently had a discussion. I don't know who picked that date. I think whoever picked that date was single. Started on Valentine's Day. Now, I think the same would apply to standards of a lot of things, be it clothes or, manufacturing of, high-end manufacturing, be it military or military consumer. The standards since we don't manufacture everything and since we are lazy in, let me just say stingy,
yeah,
to invest in our own research and development, chances are very high we are going to adopt. So everything that we are going to adopt is going to come with its own standards, and chances are very high we are going to use the standards of whoever we are going to adopt stuff from.
Yeah.
That's it. It would be weird for us to adopt someone's machines and then coming up with our own machines, with our own standards, because you will keep going back to the manufacturer for parts.
But the downside is also, Helmut, we are not creating our own technology.
Yeah, actually, we are doing the opposite. We are shipping out. I mean, like, we're shipping out of our raw resources that we would be using to manufacture something.
Yeah,
that is our biggest problem. We're gonna get to standards later, but right now, it's the shipment of raw material in its raw form.
Like, we
when we start talking about manufacturing, research and development, we will get to standards. Until then, I don't see the reason why. I mean, why we're even having this conversation, but, well, it covered today's home run.
It's because development was in there.
Uh-huh, yeah, development.
Yeah, we had development in there, yeah. So, on that particular note, guys, catch us again tomorrow, same time, same place here on the home run. Obviously, as David is thanking us before he Goliaths us in one or other manner in terms of evicting us. But yeah, catch us same time, same place, and enjoy the rest of your programming in our company.
Yeah, until tomorrow.